Welcome to the Strategy Session Podcast, where ASI's editors provide tips and tactics to help promotional product professionals improve their businesses. In every episode, we go one-on-one with a business strategy expert to gather winning insights. The conversations are sure to be insightful and entertaining.
Hi, welcome to the Strategy Session Podcast. I'm Chris Ruvo. Today we'll be speaking with Mary Madeline, one of the most popular conservative voices in America. Pundit, political contributor, and radio host, Mary has worked for some of the biggest names in American politics, including three presidents. This July, she and her husband, leading Democratic strategist James Carville, will be the keynote speakers at the ASI Show Chicago. Mary, thank you for joining us.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
All right, excellent. Let's jump right into some of these questions here. I'm going to start you out with a hard one. The campaign runs from Donald Trump and Bernie Sanders. I think it's safe to say they caught some of the political establishment by surprise. So among that establishment, among the elites, what is the talk regarding why these candidates thrived and what their success means for American politics going forward?
Well, I am a member in good standing. I think of the establishment as being... that's defined by having done it for 35 years, but I was not surprised at all. After two successive tsunami elections where the electorate voiced their concern about the overreach of government, their opposition to the ACA or Obamacare and other government growth that was encroaching on their lives, they sent politicians or elected officials to Washington to reverse course, and they were ignored. So, of course, it's going to generate a candidacy of an unlikely non-politician, even though Bernie is a politician, but he is an unlikely one, being the only avowed socialist that I know of, or at least avowed, let's put that in quotes, in Congress. And Donald Trump has a kind of, his attraction is not just that he's tapping into the anger, people are right to be angry, but he's suggesting that the premise of the policies that are disadvantaging mainstream Americans is faulty and that we should attack the premise. I don't, as a policy wonkish kind of person, I'd like to hear more policy prescriptions from him, but I'm not surprised at the attraction to him.
Fair enough. Kind of longer-term implications of their runs. What does their success mean for politics going forward? Are we going to see more quote-unquote outliers or make runs of this nature with the level of success they've had?
We're going to see a constant attempt to make Washington less intrusive or more outcome-based, if you will. I do think that it will become evident quickly the further we get into this campaign, and particularly if Trump gets elected, which I think he will, that policy is a subject area expertise, and it doesn't have to be as cumbersome or complicated as it is, but it does need to be outcome-based. And until we are successfully legislating again or de-legislating such encroachments on our individual opportunities, then we're going to see these kind of unlikely candidacies. But I do think the political profession, if you will think that they always run the next campaign like the last campaign. And what's successful about Donald Trump and Bernie Sanders is not their particular candidacy. It's that they reflect for the moment an anti-politician. And Bernie just reflects a transition that's going on in the Democratic Party. And Trump represents a dissatisfaction with the Republican Party, then, which all of that is a representation of there aren't two parties. There's only one big party where that makes a lot of policies that the policymakers aren't subjected to, but the country is to the country's disadvantage.
Gotcha. Now, you mentioned in there that you do believe that Donald Trump is going to be the 45th president. Why do you feel that way?
Because, first, he is expanding the electorate. All conservatives are angry, but not all angry people are conservative. So he's going to get people who really support him, deeply support him, and they're low propensity voters. So he's expanding the electorate. In the final analysis, I think that conservatives like me need to see more of more policy and principles out of him. But a lot of conservatives will be, they'll just be opposed to a third term of Obama, and they'll be opposed to Hillary, who is not a change agent. Mrs. Clinton is anything but a change agent. And I think he'll have to clean up his act somewhat. In recent days, he's been doing teleprompter speeches, and he knows he has to get into policy more. But I think there's such a dissatisfaction with liberal governance and political correctness and lack of security, this horrific, horrific tragedy and act of terrorism in Orlando being the most recent example, that people will want to, if not embrace Trumpism or Trump, they will reject Hillaryism.
I gotcha. Once he takes office, how do you think that he will shape the economic climate in 2017?
Say that again?
If he does indeed make it to office, how do you think Donald Trump will shape the economic climate in the country in 2017 and beyond?
Well, how Mr. Trump shapes the economic climate remains to be seen. What I sort of know of some of the tenets of what he said to date about his economic policies, they were not all auger progress. We cannot have a trade war. We have to be free market. We have to have a competitive corporate tax rate. We have to have a diminution of regulatory excess. We have to have more transparency in our regulations, and we have to have fewer regulations. So if not lower taxes, more broad-based, fair, uncomplicated tax system. So I think if he does some of those things, there's a lot of pent-up demand, and there's a lot of stalled capital, and there's a lot of desire for not just employment but careers again that will be unleashed. It just does he have, if he, being a good businessman does not mean you understand everything about the economy, but we've seen by this Obama tenure what is bad economic policy, as is evidenced by the new normal growth of under 2% on average. That's not what this country is all about. And that we've also seen what works. We've seen in states where governors have put in place outcome-based policies that they've been successful in reducing unemployment, growing their economies, balancing their budgets, reforming their tax and regulatory code. So I think if he follows the example of what is already out there succeeding, and if he puts in place policies that can be measured, either if they're working or not working, then he can run around and be entertaining.
I gotcha. Let's take the focus off the Oval Office for a moment. Over the next 4 years, what are going to be some of the biggest challenges facing small businesses, the guy with the shop down the street? What's going to be their biggest issues, and how can they potentially overcome them?
Lord have mercy. Small businesses, which are the backbone of the economy, which used to create two-thirds of all the jobs, are now growing at the slowest rate in modern history. The whole creative notion of economic creative destruction, where businesses, one, a business fails and two take its place, that's all diminished. We are now growing, we are now creating fewer businesses than are dying. So that's, that really is an undoing of our economy. What's killing small business is regulatory compliance. They cannot, they're spending their inordinate amount of capital and human resources in compliance costs. And most entrepreneurs, that's a right brain, left brain thing. They're busy entrepreneuring and creating, and they're having to be distracted either personally or financially by compliance costs. Secondly, our education system is producing too many people without job skills. Or innovative desires. So I'm not, while I believe in this generation, deeply believe in this generation, we need to connect higher education to career opportunities instead of liberals, and I mean liberal in the, I don't mean it in the political sense, and a liberal education, which I always think is good, but is unconnected to self-sustaining life. I mean, you can't, everybody can't be a poet. Somebody has to, somebody has to change the plumbing.
Gotcha, gotcha. You know, you mentioned some potential solutions there. Are there things that Washington could start doing right now to foster greater economic growth? And
well, Washington could start doing right now to foster greater economic growth is to stop much of what they are doing. I'm a gridlock girl. I founders baked gridlock into the cake because excessive legislation, excessive regulation, excessive intrusion to individual lives, which stymie innovation and entrepreneurship, and are so distant and detached from everyday life. If they would stop doing some of those things, then that would unleash economic growth. It's not what they should do, it's what they should stop doing. And if there was one thing they could do, it's to measure what they have done. In other words, there are very few provisions in federal legislation that require measurement. We have over 70, somewhere close to 100 jobs programs spread all across the government. Do you know, in all of those jobs programs, not one of the administrations of them can tell you how many jobs they've actually created, except for those who run the jobs program, okay? So if you can't measure it, then you don't know if it's working or not. And if it's, you don't know if it's working or not, it shouldn't be, it shouldn't continue to exist. So if there's one thing they could do, they could start measuring the outcome, either for good or ill, of the institute of the infrastructure and the programs that are currently in place, and undo the ones, or cease the ones, sunshine out, whatever you want to call it, the ones that aren't working or they cannot measure. They're two distinct things. You can measure something that's not working, but if you can't measure it, then you've got to guess, it's, you got to err on the side of it, it isn't value added, and eliminate those programs. And if something is working, a lot of programs work, or we've grown accustomed to them or dependent on them, from Social Security to Medicare, et cetera, but they're anachronistic. They need to be reformed. They were instituted in another time, pre the information technology age, a different demographic makeup of our country. So those have to be reformed. Our regulatory system needs to be reformed. Our tax code needs to be reformed. So they could do a lot of those things, and they know how to do them because, and I say this having been in national government for 35 years, there's been endless bipartisan commissions. We know what the answers are. We lack the political will.
Gotcha. Now, you mentioned your involvement in national government, and you've obviously worked for some hugely significant and important people. Of all those people that you've worked for, is there one that you could kind of point to as being maybe the most charismatic or maybe even the most capable of executing a plan that would be effective for improving the lives of everyday people?
Well, charismatic is in the eye of the beholder. Charisma, to me, is contemplative, observant policy makers, and not people who don't understand politics, but politicians who operate at the whim of passion, of the trendy passion. That's not contemplative or smart. So my favorite, I've been privileged to work with so many and really have admired them all, but my favorite in terms of my preference for charisma, to use your word, is Dick Cheney. The man never suggested any advice that he hadn't thought all the way through, and his job was to synthesize all the different views and provide the deepest of thoughts from which all sides of thought, from which the president can make a final choice. And of the choices that the vice president himself preferred, he always thought them all the way through and all the way out. I cannot tell you the number of meetings I sat in where he would ask questions that foresaw a playing out of a specific policy. If we do this, then what's going to happen? If that happens, then what happens? A lot of policymakers on both sides, their policy prescriptions are focused on solving an immediate problem with little understanding or reflection on unintended consequences. So I really think he's not only a man of great integrity, but great long-term depth.
Gotcha. Very, very interesting insights there. Last question here. How do you feel about the country going forward? Do you think we're going to get on a better trajectory, or what's your outlook for the United States?
I'm wildly optimistic. I'm wildly optimistic. It requires a reflection on what was great about us, about our country, why we are exceptional, and not because we are exceptional people, but when we say America was exceptional, it's because we are an exception at our founding to the rule of autocratic or centralized governance, and that is an exception in the history of governing in the history of humankind. So if we could reflect on that, get back to the thinking that went into our founding in the first place, and onto that we add this millennial generation, which now outnumbers the baby boomer generation, who has a whole new way of problem solving because they're the iPad generation, and they can multitask. They can mentally multitask, and they're not encumbered with solutions that are predicated on this is the way it's always been done. And they're optimistic, and they're idealistic. And on top of that, we have just an embarrassment of riches in this country. We have energy resources. We have the technology and the innovative capacity to make our energy environmentally compatible with clean living. So I'm and we have a lot of pent-up demand for careers, and we love our families, and we love our country. So, yes, I'm wildly optimistic, and if you get 20 miles outside the Beltway, you're pretty optimistic, too.
Gotcha. Well, Mary, thank you so much for joining us today. We really appreciate you being with us.
Well, thank you so much. I appreciate and look forward to the conference. See you soon.
Once again, folks, that was leading conservative commentator Mary Madeline. You can hear more from her at the ASI Show Chicago, which runs from July 12th through July 14th at McCormick Place. Head to asishow.com for more details. I'm Chris Ruvo. Thanks for listening.
This has been the latest episode of ASI's Strategy Session Podcast. To listen to all of our podcasts, go to asicentral.com/podcast.